Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Welcome back. Coming up on this week's show, Turner quits the Champions League. Fox lays off soccer producers in cost-cutting measures. MLS tournament to play during Florida's rising COVID numbers. First impressions of NBC's new Peacock streaming service. beIN Sports blacks out Serie A broadcasts in 35 countries. Plus, we have letters from you, the listeners, in our mailbag section. I'm Christopher Harris, a.k.a. The Gaffer, joined alongside my co-host, Kartik Krishnaiyer. Kartik, welcome back, and what an episode to come back on. You took a break for a couple of weeks, and anyone that's been following you very closely has kind of seen the updates from Florida as far as all the COVID numbers and the stats. But I mean, what an episode to come back to. This might be a 2-hour special.
Yeah, so much going on in the football world and in the world of soccer media, and the restarts in all the European leagues, all the major European leagues outside of Germany, which obviously had already started, and France, which aborted their season. So kind of a soccer overload week, to be honest with you.
Yeah, well, so let's start with there, too. So we've got a lot of news to get to, so we'll get to that in a little bit. But lots of matches. I mean, this past week, I probably watched... watched about 16 or 18 matches, just watching probably 3 or 4 games a day. It's been intense. So I've seen a lot of football. But what for you has been your favorite match that you've watched this last week?
Oh, yeah, it was Atalanta-Lazio yesterday on ESPN. And Mark Donaldson and Matteo Benetti. So you have your top commentator crew on this match. It's a match between two top four clubs. Lazio is on the doorstep of challenging Juventus for the title. They get out to a 2-goal lead. Atalanta, as they always do, is playing open. They're playing free-flowing football. The first Lazio goal, which happened in 5th or 6th minute, was on an own goal on a counterattack where the retreating Atalanta defender unfortunately got a touch on a cross and put it in the back of his own net. But then Atalanta fights back, and they get a goal back before halftime, and then they score twice in the second half. And it was just back and forth, really good football, just a phenomenal match. Maybe we'll get into this when we talk about what we watch, but for whatever reason, and I'm not alone, I thought maybe it was just a very isolated opinion, but it's not, as it turns out, from judging by Twitter and talking to some folks. Italy has restarted, Serie A has restarted, and the product has looked more like the product was before COVID than the Bundesliga, Premier League, or La Liga. And I don't know, I don't have necessarily an explanation for that, but we can talk that through.
Yeah, I saw, you might be right on this one, Carter, because you've watched more Serie A matches than I have. I watched the Coppa Italia semifinals right before the Serie A came back, so a few days before, and those two semifinals I watched, a lot of missed chances, a lot of players that were not razor sharp. That seemed very kind of very, very, very below par. It seemed very much players not at that fitness level quite yet. Now, I've watched a couple of Serie A matches since then. I watched Milan against Lecce, which was kind of a really one-sided game. And I did watch the Atalanta-Lazio game at the same time as watching Liverpool against Crystal Palace. And I had it on two screens and was trying to keep in touch, or kind of trying to watch both of them at the same time. And any listener who's tried to do that, you know how difficult it is. And I was paying more attention to the Liverpool-Crystal Palace game just because of the title implications, and also seeing... You mean Liverpool at the top, which has been a little while since I've seen that. And I saw the goals flying in, but yeah, maybe you're right, Kartik. Maybe, well, what does that say about the Premier League though, too? Because the Premier League, from what I've seen thus far, and it's starting to get a little bit better, I think, as far as the games go and the levels of playing, but it's still not there yet. It's still, you can see that the players are not match sharp. And technically, not that good. I mean, there's been a few goals of wonder and excitement, but for the most part, the Premier League seems to be slower in picking up and getting back to the levels that they were before COVID.
Yeah, I think part of that has to do with the lockdown and the severity of the lockdown in England versus the other countries. Now, everybody had a horrible lockdown situation. And initially, early on in the COVID crisis, Italy was the epicenter in Europe. Then it became Spain. But I think also people in England tend to live in smaller homes, maybe don't just have a garden. They don't have a place to walk about. Maybe I'm just searching here for explanations. But and then England's case count began to increase a little later than in Spain and Italy. Now, by a little later, I mean just we're talking about weeks, not months, right? Obviously. Yep. But I completely agree with that. I think the Premier League matches that I've watched have looked labored. They've been pretty slow. There have been and people who follow me know that I often say the Premier League has a lot more bad giveaways than people want to say it does because of the entertainment value. But the bad giveaways have been more noticeable in the Premier League this past week than I think any time in the past. Now, here's maybe the real kicker. We're used to really active and engaging crowds in England. We're used to really active and engaging crowds in Germany. Spain, not as much, but in Spain, we're used to there still being some kind of crowd influence. Italy, quite honestly, we're used to watching matches where, okay, if there's a crowd, they're behind the track, they're not very vocal, or we're people like me are mentally tuning it out because it's the Lazio ultras or the Inter ultras, and it's these really kind of undesirable elements in supporters groups. So I think Serie A playing in front of empty stadiums is not – it's not a big – it doesn't seem as abnormal as those other leagues playing in front of empty stadiums, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. It's not as drastic because what we heard before, unless you were playing in front of in Juventus' new stadium, which is one of the exceptions, but for the most part, the crowd is usually pretty subdued. Even in the San Siro, sometimes at times during some games, it's background noise, but it's not really front and center. But that's the thing about the Premier League, though, too. I mean, obviously, I love the Premier League, love watching it, love the history, the tradition. I mean, some of these clubs. But it's not the same without the fans and the atmosphere, and where the Premier League really is kind of specializes in what makes the Premier League different. When you watch a game, is usually the speed of the game. It's usually pretty fast and reckless. Second, it's usually pretty physical, and then third, it's the fans and the atmosphere, the crowds, the singing, the banter, the back and forth, and without that fans and atmosphere, what you get to really focus in on then is just the technical, what you see in front of your eyes. You watch that more closely, and it has exposed some of the technical limitations of some of the teams compared to... Now, I've been watching last week or so, I've been watching a ton of La Liga, and even the clubs, Villarreal, Valladolid, Granada, some of these teams are definitely less glamorous. Some of these teams are fantastic in terms of just how good they are technically, some great players. And I'm not seeing that with the Premier League, especially the clubs, in the bottom half of the table. It's very mediocre for the most part.
So I'm so glad you mentioned that, because one of the things that has frustrated me to no end on Twitter, and my followers know this, for the last 5 years or more is the number of fans of the Premier League, particularly American fans of the Premier League, who say Spain is a two-team league. I mean, more recently, they've said it's a three-team league because of Atleti, and none of the other teams could be competitive in the Premier League, and it's a joke beyond that. And I keep pointing out to them, if you watch a match in Spain and you see the way those teams retain the ball and are able to move the ball around, I think most of them would be very successful in the Premier League. And it's a matter of style, it's a matter of tactics, it's a matter of kind of football. But so many of the Premier League fans, and again, I think it's more American fans than fans across the globe, only know one type of football, which is Premier League football. And because a game is slower and more technical in Spain, or maybe they're not watching at all, but if they are, because a game is slower and more technical, they assume it's inferior. And that's just not the case, particularly with La Liga. I think, and I will go again on record saying this, I think top 10, top 12 teams in La Liga could all hang in the top six in the Premier League.
But that's the thing.
But that's the thing, we don't really know because the style of football is so different.
Right. But that's the thing, though, too. With La Liga, the Bundesliga, I would include in that too, and Serie A, those are leagues that are more for the purists. Those are the leagues that are more the technical, very, very superior, I believe. And the Premier League really is for the mainstream, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, with the Premier League, but there is an allure about the Premier League that you don't get with other leagues. There's almost like a force that makes you want to know how the Premier League teams are doing, what incidents happened in matches, what managers said. And if you don't know what's happening in the Premier League, some people would think, okay, what do you know about soccer? It is the go-to league that pulls you in. And if you're not watching the Premier League, you mean, for a soccer fan, it would be kind of a strange, like, why aren't you watching the Premier League? Because everyone else is.
Yeah, there was somebody who commented on my Twitter this week who I know is a big soccer fan, watches MLS, watches the Bundesliga, I think is into La Liga also, that told me, oh, I haven't watched the Premier League in years, and I turned it on, and it was, you know, it was basically horrible. is this what's been happening in the league, et cetera, et cetera? And I was surprised because this person is active on Twitter, is a soccer fan, they hadn't been watching the Premier League. And I know that it's a person that comments a lot when I put out Bundesliga or American soccer tweets, and I thought of, and I'm like, yeah, I guess that person hasn't interacted with me on the Premier League in some time. But it was so weird to me because I assumed that's like the default for everybody. And that assumption, yeah, I guess, sometimes is wrong. Although the TV ratings tell us it's basically right, of course.
Well, that's the thing, too. We'll get more into that a little bit later in the TV ratings because that's the thing, is that the TV ratings are not – you mean the people are not watching the purest soccer leagues. They're watching the leagues that Well, I think at the end of the day, Kartik, I was thinking about more about this morning before the podcast. It comes down to what team do you support? I mean, what's your number one team? And for me personally, and it's the same goes for you, the listeners, is the team that you support the most, because some of us have more than one team that we support, but the major team that we support, that's what we gravitate to. So for me personally, I mean, a Swansea City fan, seeing Swansea play on streaming, watching that live last weekend, it made my whole weekend. I was so happy. So, I mean, they won, which always helps. But just to see my team playing back and watching it was an incredible experience. It had been, 3.5 months, almost 4 months before I'd actually seen them play previously. And I think that's the thing, though, too, is that when you think about soccer fans around the world, but for this podcast, mostly in the United States, is what team do you support? What's your number one team? And that's what you gravitate towards. And you might watch some of those other games in that league because they have, there's implications on your team. But that's the pull. That's really kind of what pulls people in. So it's not that people don't watch La Liga because of whatever reason. It may be that they don't have a La Liga team that they support. And I mean, to me, that's I mean, it's an obvious thing, but it is. I mean, we'll see in the TV ratings a little bit later. It has a huge impact. What team do you support? And then you mean with those numbers? Obviously, the bigger clubs have the bigger number of supporters, and usually those clubs have bigger viewing figures.
there's also curiosity about certain projects and aspects. You know, I'm a bit of a maybe not so closeted anymore Everton fan, even though Manchester City is my club. There's always been kind of a sister club thing between City and Everton. For those who don't know history of the game, you know, even people like Howard Kendall and Peter Reid and so many players who played for both clubs through the years, including Adrian Heath, right, who I think everybody in American soccer knows. And they were always the second kind of people's club in the two great Northwestern cities. So I have an interest in Everton. And, you know, I'm not watching the Premier League at all, Chris. I'll admit it. This weekend, I'm watching Serie A. I'm watching La Liga. I'm watching the Bundesliga, right? Obviously, Dortmund-Leipzig was a big game that I watched start to finish. And Everton's playing. I'm curious about Ancelotti and this 4-4-2 and the work that's been done. I even post for all the people who are following me for COVID information and political stuff. Hey, guys, next 2 hours is soccer. I'm watching Everton. And so, yeah, you're right about that. And it was the Merseyside Derby. I wasn't going to miss it. I was incredibly motivated to watch it. And on that match, by the way, I think a couple things. One, hearing Arlo White, he mixes some really good statistical analogies, and you know, he brought up Paul Rideout's goal at Wembley in 1995 in the FA Cup final, last major trophy Everton's won. He does some really good stuff during these broadcasts, and then he brings up American sporting analogies, right? Which I think, in my mind, have no applicability to what's going on the pitch. So that's kind of the good and bad about him as a commentator. And in that match, I thought it was really interesting to see a derby at Goodison without the fans, Chris. Mm-hmm. I think may have helped Everton, and they were the better team, and they should have won. There wasn't the sort of kind of pressure that they normally feel, because they haven't beaten now Liverpool since September or October of 2010. I think it was October of 2010. And they've even played in cup matches, so that's more than that's 20 matches or so that they played that they haven't beaten them. This was the kind of freest I had seen Everton. You know, they were playing without fear. Now, maybe that's Ancelotti. Maybe that's Ancelotti now having some time on the training ground without matches post-COVID lockdown by post-COVID, I mean in the UK, not in the US, obviously.
Right.
But there was something about them not having a crowd, and I wanted to mention this morning, Chris, that maybe clubs that have historically been snake-bit. Another one to look at in Spain would be Valencia, mm-hmm. because Valencia has always had this love-hate relationship because they have such a passionate supporters base that sometimes the pressure is too much. But I felt like Everton played freer in this match and should have won. They should have gotten all 3 points without a crowd at Goodison.
Yeah,
quite frankly.
Yeah, for sure. And looking at my notes from the game, I wrote. I usually write notes before the podcast. And I wrote, I can hardly hear the crowd noise, virtually non-existent. Player voices are more easily heard. And that's one good thing about this match. I mean, the match itself was pretty boring, I thought. It was a poor first half, and the second half wasn't that much better either. Everton should have won this match, definitely, and they played exceedingly well. But I'll do a spoiler here. I mean, the number of viewers who watch this game in the United States was 1.2 million people, which is a huge number. I mean, and that's something that, going back to the crowd noise for a second, though, too, is just that I guess the Premier League has figured out how to do it. I'm still not that happy with it. I still think the Bundesliga is much better. But they figured out something in between where, okay, it's not hideous and it's not too obnoxious. It's kind of like in between, and you get to hear the players more easily. The one thing that when watching this game, though, Kartik, came to mind for me was that and this has got very little to do with this game, but how long has it been since we've heard a John Champion commentary? And this was a game that I missed John Champion. I mean, obviously John Champion doing the Premier League last season, but it's
Amazon.
Been,
I guess if you have Amazon,
well,
if you
in the US,
Prime in the UK, yeah, in the US. I mean, MLS matches, right?
Which would have been
a lot of them in the MLS's back tournament, but. The thing that I also want to mention then on that score is we've gotten into a point with the Premier League with John Champion now in the U.S. doing U.S.-based games that you either have a match called by Peter Drury. There's a class of commentators. It's Peter Drury and everyone else for me now. And again, it's when Drury calls a match, I take note. I'm listening to the commentary as much as I'm watching the match. And he's guiding me through the match. I think with other commentators that are still calling Premier League matches, and this is not a shot at anyone, but this is just more praise for Peter Drury. They're calling the match, and it's kind of – the commentary is nice, but you can live without the commentary. If Drury is calling a match, as he was the other day, was Spurs West Ham, right? I'm drawn into that commentary, and I'm listening to him as attentively, and whoever his co-commentator is, as attentively as I'm listening to attentively as I'm watching the match. So that's something that I think has happened over the course of the last few years, as you've seen so many of the commentators that we kind of got accustomed to around the league, the John Champions, the Martin Tylers. Martin Tyler does fewer matches now. The Ian Darks and so many other commentators mm-hmm. that we're accustomed to. Rob Hawthorne's another one. They'll come to mind as we keep going through the show. I don't need to name them all, but right. I think you get my point.
Yeah, well, that's the thing about the Bundesliga. I've got a newfound appreciation for the Bundesliga and the level of their world feed commentators. I mean, it's fantastic. I mean, that's one takeaway from the Bundesliga being where they had a monopoly on soccer for about 3 to 4 weeks is the Kevin Hatchards or the Phil Barneys and the Lutz Fannenspiel, etc. I mean, some really, really good commentators. And with the Premier League, I missed John Champion. I guess the last time I heard a John Champion call would have been an MLS game on ESPN, and so maybe the first week of the season. It's been so long. I don't know. I miss John Champion.
Now, if you'd watch some of the classic Premier League matches on NBCSN in the middle of all of this, more often than not, John Champion was calling them. It was pretty unbelievable. The ratio of John Champion to non-John Champion was probably 1-1. Half the games that they showed. So you would think it would be Martin Tyler, right? If you're thinking historically, who would call most of these big matches. But it was actually John Champion, I guess because they were taking the international feed, right? If they were taking the Sky feed, it might have been different. But I have gotten my fix of John Champion. And obviously when the MLS's back tournament begins if it begins, as people who follow me know, I'm solely obsessed with COVID numbers in Florida for the last 3 weeks. And while I haven't been on the show, and I'm very alarmed by it, but we'll get to that later. But if it does begin and conclude, you'll hear a lot of John Champion, I'm sure, during that tournament.
So one more thing before we go to the news, and that is this past weekend was a historic moment, so to speak, for the Premier League and NBC Sports, in that they had their first game ever shown on Peacock, which is the new NBC Sports, or actually a new NBC streaming platform that's scheduled to launch to the general public on July 15th. So the game was Bournemouth against Crystal Palace. It was the late game on Saturday. All the games that are available on NBC Sports Gold are available on Peacock. And so I'm a Comcast subscriber. I get to my internet through Comcast. I don't have cable television through them. I've cut the cord, so to speak. I still need them for the actual internet service, though. They got me there. But with the internet service, if you do subscribe to Comcast, you can get they give you a free Flexbox, which is a streaming over the top streaming device. So I said, okay, well, if it's the Premier League, I had held off on actually getting this, but because of the Premier League, I said, okay, you know what? Let me go ahead and get it and see what it looks like. Hooked it up. Was able to log in, hooked it up for the game, and had a chance to poke around a little bit with Peacock just to kind of get a feel for what it is. And as soon as the game was over, I unplugged it, put it back in the box and stowed it away. It really is just a dumb device. You can get your free, a lot of the free channels that are out there, the free movies that are out there. Pretty much every streaming device now, or streaming like Tubi and others, have this whole huge archive of free, mostly movies, and then there's ads on it. And with Peacock, they have that, but you can also add your Netflix onto there. You can add some other your other streaming devices too. It's meant to be kind of your go-to streaming device, but to me, Roku is a million times better, as is an Amazon Fire TV stick. And that's what it's trying to replace. It's trying to have that object, you mean, next to your television set, and have that rather than the Amazon Fire or the Roku. But yeah, was not impressed. And but I think the future is going that way. I think you'll see more and more games available through Peacock. And I guess we'll have to wait and see about next season if they're going to increase that number. But NBC is pushing Peacock big time.
So yeah, they are, and I was very frustrated by this specific game, because this specific match. I like I said, I've been focusing on Serie A, Bundesliga, La Liga over the weekend, but David Brooks is back, and he was arguably probably one of my top five favorite players in the Premier League the previous season when he was fit. Right. So this is his first match back, and I'm excited. I'm like, okay, I am, and it was later, so I am going to watch Bournemouth Palace, and didn't even think. I assumed, okay, I know the West Ham match, West Ham Wolves is on NBC, so the 2:45 match or 3 o'clock match Eastern time, that'll go back. That'll be on NBCSN, and there's some other sporting event on. And then I realized, oh my goodness, that's right. Rebecca Lowe did say that earlier in the day, right? When I was flipping channels, right? Like I said, I was focusing on the other leagues, but I would flip occasionally and check out the Premier League. Oh my goodness, I'm not going to get to see this match. And I was excited about this match for one player. So no, I have not seen David Brooks in his return. Bournemouth's not playing well, right? And the Ryan Fraser situation has intensified their problems. But I missed the match that I was going to watch because it was on Peacock, and I do not have Comcast, so it's not available to me yet.
Right. Yeah, the only way you would have been able to see it is to subscribe to NBC Sports Gold. And pretty much, I think up until now, I think I've refused to do that. I think maybe – no, actually, I just subscribed for a little while. All right, Kartik. Let's move on to TV streaming news, and I'll have you kick it off.
Yeah, I think as everybody probably by the time they listen to this podcast knows, TNT has opted out of its 3-year contract to cover UEFA club events, the Champions League, etc. And this means that the tournament resumption of both Champions League and Europa League, which are going to happen in August, are now as of now, not on U.S. television. Now, Chris, obviously, there are any number of things that can happen. I don't anticipate it would not be on U.S. television, but Turner has opted out of their deal early. And I guess there was a trigger in their contract that they were able to exercise to do this.
Yeah, well, that's a strange thing, too. Speaking to sources within the business, they were saying it's really strange and very rare that you'd have an opt-out clause like this, that a broadcaster could say, you know what I mean, during any stage of the tournament, we're not going to show any more of it. Thanks, but here you go, UEFA, you can have it back. That was very strange. So I'm not sure if there were – that doesn't make any sense at all. So I don't know if Turner was a little bit lackluster or a little bit uncertain about the Champions League anyway, and wanted to, the lawyers wanted to insert that clause just in case it didn't work out. But yeah, what it means for listeners and what it means for viewers in the United States is that we don't know yet who's going to show the English language Champions League games for the remainder of the tournament, which begins in early August, and that'll be both the Europa League, which is I think the round of 16 second legs, and there's a couple of I think round of 16 legs to actually four games in the Champions League before it moves to the quarterfinals. So for the rest of this season, so for August and most of the finals, I mean the finals for the Champions League and the Europa League are at the end of August. And then for next season right now on the English language side, we do not know who's going to broadcast those, because Turner Sports has quit the Champions League. It'll go out for bid. I'm sure that UEFA has already started discussions with the ESPNs of the world, the CBSs of the world, maybe even the Foxes of the world, maybe even NBC, etc. The thinking is that this makes total sense for CBS, if they're ready, to go ahead and begin with the Champions League a season early, and they may not be quite ready to go in, full steam ahead with a studio and those things, but at least for the actual rest of this season's Champions League and the Europa League, maybe they can put that on CBS All Access, and maybe a couple of those games on CBS over the air, and use mostly the world feed so that at least they have something there, and it's maybe not the finished product, so to speak. And then to focus this summer for the month or so that they'll have to work on it, to focus on their coverage for next season and then build it up from there. But we don't know. It could go a whole bunch of different ways. But what we do know is that Univision still has the Spanish language rights. And really, this one, to me, says a lot about the mistakes that Turner Sports have made since day one. The mistakes they made was that they didn't get the Spanish language rights. So throughout this whole Champions League under Turner Sports, we could go to, sometimes Univision will have the game over the air, free to air, Unimas, TUDOANE, etc. So whether you speak Spanish or not, you could easily find the Champions League on the Spanish language side. And those numbers have been huge. And I'm sure Univision was celebrating on Wednesday when they found out this news, because this really solidifies their spot as the go-to place for the Champions League. And for the English language side, for Turner Sports, It's not just Turner Sports, though. It's Turner Sports and Bleacher Report. But to me, it's just a catalogue of huge mistakes that they made. And towards the end of the coverage that they were doing, it got better when they figured out, okay, let's just do one studio. Let's figure out all the problems with BR Live and let's fix those. And I think they were finally getting to a point where they were starting to actually do some good coverage and learning from their mistakes. But at the end of the day, Kartik, this is really kind of a black mark on Turner Sports and Bleacher Report. This will not go down in the history books as a success. This will be a failure, a huge failure.
Yeah, and obviously Univision is the big short-term beneficiary. I said earlier American television, I meant American English language television. Univision, a lot of us have already started watching more matches on Univision. I have in the last two seasons. But I thought Turner's best hour was probably the last hour, ironically, that they had a Champions League coverage, which was a studio team of Kate Abdo, Stu Holden, and company, Moadu, after the Liverpool Atleti match, as COVID was beginning to strike Europe, as there was positive reports coming out about players, they did a really good job that day, that Wednesday, that final Wednesday in which they covered Champions League. And I thought, okay, maybe they've turned a corner. And it turns out that was the final time they would broadcast the competition.
So the question has to be asked, why would Turner Sports and Bleacher Report do this? Why would they quit on the Champions League and not fulfill their contractual obligation and at this stage in the actual contract? And there's two reasons, really. I think the first reason is that they and actually, just to backtrack for a second, in February and March, I went up to Atlanta. So I got a behind-the-scenes tour of the Bleacher Report studio, the Turner studio, where they did the Champions League, and spoke to a lot of the executives and sat in some discussions with the executives to learn to find out more about them, and that was the kind of really for me it was a really the light bulbs went off in terms of they were really really upset about losing the Champions League rights, and they were upset because they had only been into the current cycle for just over a season, so basically a season and a half into the current 3-year cycle. And they found out that they had lost the rights. They put in a bid, but they had lost the rights to CBS, who put in a much larger bid. So they were pissed. They were angry. They were upset. They were disappointed. And it's all those things combined. It feels a little bit childish, a little bit petty, that they've decided to rather invest any more money into broadcasting the Champions League for the remainder of this season and next season. It's almost as if they're kind of a spoiled child and they're just kind of throwing the toys out of the carriage or the pram. And there's a little bit of that feeling. But the second part of it, though, too, is I think it's more of a business decision, is that I'm sure they were looking at the end of the rest of the season and next season and going, okay, how are we going to make any money off this? I mean, we could go ahead and put all the games on streaming, maybe on HBO Max, which is their new streaming product, or maybe BR Live. But BR Live is getting wrapped up and going to be put inside the Bleacher Report app at some point in the near future, probably this summer. And I think they were looking from a business point of view and probably thinking, with everything going on and the amount of money that they have to spend on talent, etc., and the Champions League anyway is a tough product, a tough competition to sell to advertisers, because those Heineken ads you see, those Pepsi ads that you see, those are ads that they make no money from. Those are ads that Heineken and Pepsi and other advertisers do a global deal with UEFA. And UEFA says to broadcasters worldwide, if you want to show the Champions League and the Europa League, you have to put these ads into the coverage, and you will make no money from those. So it limits the amount of money that a broadcaster such as Turner Sports can actually make off it. And with Bleacher Report, maybe they thought with BR Live going away soon anyway, maybe it just didn't make the financial sense to continue this. And it's rather than to go ahead and fulfill the contract, I think they felt, okay, we don't really care about this product anyway. We've lost it. Why put any more resources into this? Let's just give it back.
Yeah, one last thing I want to say is this demonstrates the trouble with the 3-year rights cycles of UEFA and a lot of leagues of soccer leagues around the world. That and the Premier League does a 3-year rights cycle. Also, they've never had a case like this. Yeah,
six years for NBC Sports
for NBC, but it's 3 years in domestically. And it's generally been 3 years.
Yeah.
In the US until the NBC thing, and we don't know if the next rights cycle will be 3 years or 6 years in the US, but. This shows you the trouble, because you're putting the a tender out for bid at the beginning of the second season. Now, I suppose it still could have been later, and Turner could have gotten through most of this year before they knew that they had lost the rights if it had been done differently. But this happened to Fox also. Remember, Fox was in the middle of their next to last season, and we didn't UEFA didn't officially announce it, but you and others had reported, Chris, at the time – Turner had gained the rights, I think, a full year and a half before they actually assumed the rights. So this is an issue with 3-year rights cycles, and broadcasters who throw a petulant fit, as Turner appears to have done here. I don't like it, but at the same time, I think I can understand it, because it is so difficult to then assume the rights for a property, have a season where. Admittedly, things didn't go very well for Turner, but you're trying new things. It's a completely new sport for you to cover, and you're figuring things out. And by the time you really begin to figure things out, guess what? It's back up for bid. That's difficult.
Yeah. So the question now is that you would think that CBS would go in and say, okay, CBS is going to say, hey, we can start a little bit earlier than we originally planned for. And we can probably get, I would think, the UEFA Champions League and Europa League at a lower price. It should be. I don't think there's too many broadcasters that are going to be willing to pay a lot of money for this, because whoever it is, say it's Fox. Say Fox says, okay, we want to have the Champions League, but it's only going to be for a few games in August, and then it's going to be for one season. That has very little value to Fox or any other broadcaster. For CBS, there's value in terms of just being able to start things up sooner. We know that the CBS All Access, which is going to appeal to soccer fans beginning this weekend with the NWSL Challenge Cup, it begins Saturday and goes through for a whole month. And here's another opportunity for CBS All Access to say, hey, not only do we have NWSL, but starting in August, hypothetically, we will have the Champions League and the Europa League. Go ahead and watch it and continue the summer of soccer. And then for next season, you can watch it there too, as well as maybe some of the games, maybe the final and some of the big games on CBS over the air. But I'd imagine that CBS would get a bargain on this. I don't think there's too many broadcasters out there willing to unload a ton of money, even a DAZN. which DAZN has money. They want to get into really the US market outside of just boxing and fighting. This is an opportunity. But again, for one season, is it really worth it? I mean, what does that give you? But yeah, I hope CBS gets it, and this gives CBS an opportunity to really, for a lot of viewers on the English language side, to really save the Champions League, to save the Europa League, to go ahead and give it some love and to broadcast it, because not everyone will watch Spanish language broadcasts. I mean, nothing against Univision, but some people prefer to have the English language broadcast. So CBS, this is a huge opportunity, and if you get it, best of luck to you. All right, Kartik, speaking of television streaming and all that business, the second piece of news in the TV streaming news segment is that FuboTV has signed a carrier distribution deal with ESPN. This is huge news because this really puts Fubo, they were already on the map before, but this really puts them in as the number one sports streaming platform in the United States. So beginning this summer, and we don't know what the date is yet, it hasn't been announced, but customers who subscribe to Fubo TV's Fubo standard base will have access to ABC, ABC News Live, Disney Channel, Disney Junior, Disney XD, Freeform, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN3, and a whole bunch of other channels too. And there will also be some other packages available, including out-of-market for SEC Network and ACC Network, ESPNU, ESPN News, ESPN Deportes, and more. So this deal includes both live television and video on demand. So this is excellent news. The only thing I'm concerned about here, Kartik, is the price point, because Fubo already is, about $54 a month? Has a ton of channels, a ton of almost everything except for ESPN. And with this deal this summer, I mean, what does that price go up to? Do they bring it up to $65, $70 a month? And still, that's cheaper than cable for the most part. But is that going to scare some people away?
It very well could. I think ESPN is one of the things that has scared people away from cable, yeah. If I'm honest with you, because their carrier fees are much higher. And so people don't realize that. They haven't consciously said, oh, gosh, I don't want to pay for ESPN. They generally want ESPN. They don't realize how much of their cable bill is ESPN. So let's see where Fubo's price point is after this. Although this is great news for Fubo, because now they can give you essentially a complete package.
Yeah, they would have everything. I mean, even the Univision and TUDN channels, which are which Sling TV doesn't have, neither does YouTube TV. YouTube TV doesn't have beIN Sports, which Fubo has. So Fubo would have everything. It's just what is that price point? And for some people, maybe $65 a month or $70 a month would be fine to get everything, except for ESPN Plus, except for Netflix, except for CBS All Access. I mean, that's the thing. We can keep on adding all these streaming services on, which I have no problem with, because I love to have the choice of being able to watch what I want, on whatever channel I want to. But it does definitely add up. It's still less than cable. Oh, my gosh. It's a crazy world that we live in. Anyway, so sometime this summer, those channels will be added to Fubo. Next up in the TV streaming news segment, Kartik, is some big news for Major League Soccer.
The MLS is Back tournament, Chris, has been announced, the full TV schedule, the full schedule of fixtures, and a lot of interesting matches that are going to be on ESPN or a few on Big Fox, FS1, Univision, etc. But this tournament is going to be taking place in Central Florida amidst rising COVID numbers. The numbers have spiked in Central Florida over the course of the last few weeks. And let me dispel some of the pushback I keep getting when I report these numbers on Twitter and on my website, The Florida Squeeze. One, positive test rates have gone way up during this period. In early June, I think it was June 2nd or 3rd, the top positive test rate, Chris, in Orange County was 1.4%. Yesterday, which was Wednesday, we're recording this on Thursday, it was close to 20%. Okay. The second point is that the number of available hospital beds has gone down fairly dramatically in that same period in Orange County, which is where Orlando is. And the third point I'd make is the median age for newly infected COVID patients or COVID cases has gone down to around 30 years old, give or take a year or two on a daily basis. It was in the 50s earlier in the pandemic, had dropped into the 40s. So younger people are getting infected, more people are getting infected, and a larger percentage of people who are feeling sick enough to go take a test are coming back positive. In the midst of all this, MLS has gone forward with their decision to play in Orlando. And lo and behold, at the very same time, Chris, and this is significant, obviously, NWSL, you mentioned earlier, the Challenge Cup starts this weekend, and that'll be on CBS and the ramifications for Champions League, et cetera, with CBS. One team has had to withdraw completely from the Challenge Cup, which is the Orlando Pride, who had 10 positive tests, 6 among players, 4 among staff. They are not even going to travel to Utah for the resumption of the NWSL season or for the NWSL Challenge Cup. So pretty dire situation here in the state of Florida with COVID. MLS says they're in a bubble, Chris. They say, although Garber has now conceded Cooks and stuff, we're going to come in and out of the complex. But I just think there's too much risk in this. If they pull this off, great. Because I have to tell you, I think the tournament is a really cool idea, and I'm looking forward to it from a soccer standpoint. But there's just too much that can go wrong, given the situation in Central Florida. But obviously, they're not going to abort now. So we've got to just keep our fingers crossed that nothing happens.
So playing devil's advocate, though, Kartik, on this one, is that if they're inside a bubble, you mean, and all the players, the coaches, all the support staff are, you mean, staying true to all the different guidelines and not going out of that bubble and being tested every so often. You mean, is that okay? I mean, does that have any implication? Should they still go ahead and do it if everything is contained within the bubble and that's the best way that they can play this tournament without any issues?
That's a good question because, yes, in theory, they should be fine if everybody stays within the bubble. But I have too much experience in the sport to believe that everybody's going to stay in essentially a lockdown state. And Disney itself, you've stayed in Disney hotels. I don't want to say it's like a prison, but you seem very isolated, right, mm-hmm. when you're on the Disney property and premises. It only takes a few players saying, you know what, let's go out for a night on the town. And Orlando is a kind of a legendary party town in the state of Florida, which I think everybody knows, which is reportedly what happened with the Pride, right? Some of their players went out and that's what happened. They went to bars, etc. It just takes one set of disgruntled players, let's say even 2 weeks into this, 3 weeks into this. It may not happen right away. And the whole thing falls apart. So, yes, in theory, it could be okay. I think in actual practice, it's going to be very difficult to keep everybody on side, disciplined, and locked down for – now, obviously, there'll be some teams that are eliminated and leave, right?
Yeah.
But the teams that are more successful, keep everybody locked down for what will essentially be, including the training, the pre-tournament training, 6 or 6.5 weeks.
Yeah, it's a long time. It's a very, very long time. So fingers crossed, hopefully everyone sticks to the guidelines, everyone stays in that bubble, and the tournament goes on as planned. As far as the TV schedule goes, I should have looked at the numbers, but the vast majority of these games are going to be on ESPN. And it might be like, I don't know, over 60% of the games are on ESPN. There's one game on Big Fox, Fox Over the Air, which is the New York Red Bulls against Atlanta on July 11th, and that's going to be in prime time, an 8 p.m. Eastern broadcast. And there are some of the games on FS1 and some on TUDN/A, but again, the large majority on ESPN.
And should mention, sorry, go ahead. Chris, but those of you who are not familiar with the weather in Central Florida, it's hot and it's muggy this time of year. So they've launched this concept called Breakfast with MLS, which will be on ESPN during the group stage, 9 a.m. matches. So the matches, the first set of matches each day is at 9 a.m. The second set of matches is at 8 p.m. That tells you how rough the weather is. this part of the world.
It sounds like Wimbledon, a breakfast.
Yeah, breakfast at Wimbledon. That's where they obviously they lived from there.
But having lived in Florida, I still live in Florida, and you too, Kartik, and having gone to Orlando, which is the hottest part of the state with no breeze, even the 9 o'clock Eastern time game in the morning is going to be hot and humid and is going to take the toll on the players. Even the games at 8 p.m. Eastern and 10:30 p.m. Eastern, even with the sun down and the humidity, are going to take a toll on players. I mean, we've seen all the water breaks that we've seen in the Premier League, which has really slowed the game down. It's been very stop-start, especially with the number of injuries we've seen, Arsenal in particular. But I'm not expecting the quality level to be that good, Kartik. I'm expecting it to be slow and laborious games with players dealing with the heat and humidity.
I've been in one of these matches. So we had a U.S. Open Cup match, and it was the year before Lauderdale actually beat Orlando City in the Open Cup and beat D.C. United. But our first match, it wasn't the first round, right? Pro team, we got to buy. Our first match, because of a venue availability issue, we had to play it at 10:30 in the morning, which it was impossible. It was horrible. And the game went to extra time. And then went to penalties. So the players were literally dropping dead, and we didn't have you didn't get an extra substitution, a fourth substitution in those days. It was an experience that the players that were involved in that match still talk about as being kind of the worst conditions they played in. Now, granted, that was an hour and a half later for the start time and an hour and a half hotter, and it got increasingly hot and we had extra time and penalties. None of these group stage matches in MLS is back are going to have that. But 9 a.m. is still pretty hot. You're right. And you're forecasting to like 10:30, 10:45. It's going to be really hot and it's going to be very, very difficult and muggy. All these matches are on ESPN, which is a positive for MLS. But I am not sure that people watch live sports or at that time on weekday mornings. Though I will say, I think the 8 p.m. Time slots that they have, a lot of those matches on ESPN is going to be very favorable. And it'll be an easy thing for us to look at in a couple of weeks and see whether this tournament was successful or not. There should be a bump in overall television ratings based on that time slot. I guess we'll know in a few weeks.
Yeah, well, the 9 o'clock one I think is favorable because it's a Premier League friendly kickoff usually, or Serie A, or some the German league probably the German league and the Premier League.
Yeah, it's close to Bundesliga. Yeah,
but with the Premier League playing most of their matches now at like 1 p.m. kickoffs and 3:15 kickoff Eastern time, so most of those are in the afternoon. So it does give an opportunity. That gives us a window for Major League Soccer to go ahead and take advantage of that. Having a game on big ESPN, the main network, they could do pretty well on this. So, but the thing about ESPN, though, with this, Kartik, is really, to be frank, ESPN is bailing out Major League Soccer on this one, because I don't think that a Fox or even a TUDN or any broadcaster could go ahead and put on a tournament like this. ESPN is doing all the production work. It's their facility, the ESPN Wide World of Sports. It's their property. It's their bubble. It's their bubble with the being owned by Disney and having the Disney hotels nearby and having the Swan and the Dolphin and being able to bus the players to the games and all the security and all these things. No other broadcaster could do this. And not only that, though, but the TV coverage is going to be completely produced by ESPN. So they're going to be the host broadcaster. And then Fox and TUDN will take that ESPN host broadcast feed and will add their commentators, probably remotely. Even ESPN's commentators, I think John Champion and Taylor Twellman, are expected to be remote on this one too, giving the commentary and adding the graphics on the screens, etc. But without ESPN, I'm not so sure that this tournament, any tournament for Major League Soccer, would happen. And with ESPN's expertise in broadcasting and in production and in soccer, I'm sure that they'll do the best that they can with what they have. But I'm curious to see what this is going to look like because, again, it's wide open park with 20 fields and concerns over the audio and what it's going to look like, and also the playing level. but I will watch this for sure and hope that they pull it off, because it's going to be a huge undertaking. This is going to cost them, I mean, ESPN, millions of dollars to pull this off. And they're going to go in, as you can see from the TV schedule, they're going all in to try to make this into something and to make it a success. And I hope that it is successful. The other thing about this too, Kartik, is that with so few games on Fox, I mean, at the same time this week we heard that Fox had layoffs over 20 people, mostly in the production staff area, including one of the top soccer producers at Fox Soccer. And they're going through some tough times. I understand that NBC Sports, too, is also having layoffs. And it's a tough time in the industry. But you have to question, with Fox losing the Bundesliga and getting rid of a lot of the production staff, and really, for the most part, other than Major League Soccer and the FIFA tournaments, really being out of the soccer game. So I wonder and I question Fox's how much of a priority soccer is to them for the future, with them really, really kind of making a lot of pullbacks and layoffs and cuts. All right, Kartik, so moving on to one more news item, and that is that beIN Sports has shut down Serie A broadcasts worldwide in the regions where they have the rights. beIN were enraged when Serie A gave the Saudi Super Cup rights in 2018, and also a lot of Serie A clubs have been playing games in Saudi Arabia. And of course, for a lot of our listeners, we know that there is a political battle between Saudi Arabia and Qatar. And this is one of the results of it. In response to this going on with Serie A, that beIN Sports now has their coverage of Serie A blacked out in 35 Asian and Middle Eastern countries. And from what I understand, too, is that beIN Sports is saying that they're not going to pay Serie A for the rights to these games that they have. So not a good time to be Serie A, not a good time to be beIN Sports. And beIN Sports really are going all in on this whole fight against digital piracy. But it seems to be that for the most part, they're on their own in this one. And this is a huge, you mean, I'm sure if you're Serie A or if you're another league around the world, you're looking at this pretty close and saying, okay, hey, this could be my league if you mean in the future. So it'll be interesting to see what happens on this one, Kartik.
Yeah, it will be. I think this battle between Saudi Arabia and Qatar is really affecting football in so many ways. Broadcast television, obviously, with BeOutQ and beIN Sports, but also even the hosting of Super Cups and things like this. So it's hopefully the political situation gets resolved quickly, because I don't think it's been good for football.
Yeah, the other thing, one more thing about this, too, is that Saudi Arabia, I think it's KSA Sports, which is the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, is also looking to take away the Bundesliga rights from beIN Sports in certain countries too, I believe, probably the Middle East and Africa also. And so Saudi Arabia is looking to potentially, you mean, start launching their own television networks. And just again, it seems to be, in spite, just trying to battle Qatar, and using sports as leverage and trying to manipulate things in their best interests. It's a really messy situation. And of course, money talks. Both the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and Qatar have enormous amount of petrodollars. So this is unfortunate. This is something we would not like to see. All right, moving on to TV ratings, Kartik. I mentioned it, I gave the spoiler, but the big one was Everton against Liverpool on NBC on Sunday, a rare game that was on in the afternoon or mid-afternoon Eastern time, also on Telemundo too, and the viewing number for this game was 1.2 million viewers. Overall, for the first weekend of the Premier League being back in action since the restart on US television, some really strong numbers. West Ham against Wolves, this was on NBC and Telemundo, that was 830,000 people. Aston Villa, this is the one actually probably I thought that was the most impressive out of all the numbers I saw. Aston Villa against Chelsea on NBCSN on Sunday, This is the 11:15 a.m. kickoff Eastern Time. Also on Telemundo 2, 785,000 people tuned in for that one. Christian Pulisic, you think, Kartik?
Yeah, I think also these time slots were helpful, actually. But yeah, Pulisic, I guess, helps on the Chelsea thing, and obviously he had an impact when he came on in that match. The Liverpool-Everton match, I would say, has to do really with a time slot and shows the potential of the Premier League as they negotiate new TV deals and perhaps open new broadcast windows in the mid-afternoon U.S. time. How many viewers might be willing to watch a match?
Yeah, and one of the questions that came up on Twitter that was mentioned, I think it was Soccer Thoughts, I think it was, wanted us to talk about how these numbers are looking now, now that the games have restarted, these leagues have restarted, and how did they compare to beforehand? And I would say that the big number, the Everton-Liverpool, the 1.2 million, is probably just about right in terms of where that would have been even before all of us, before COVID. But the other numbers are bigger. The other numbers, the Aston Villa against Chelsea number, the 785,000 people for that one, the Friday number, the Spurs against Man United on NBCSN and on Universo, 575,000 viewers for that on a Friday afternoon.
518 for Man City Arsenal, which I know you discussed last week, is huge for Wednesday afternoon. I mean, just compare that to a Champions League broadcast,
right?
Because that's that broadcast window, and the Villa Chelsea, yeah, is higher than. So the number we usually get from those Sunday morning 11:30 a.m. type kickoffs, and it used to be 11, now it's 11:30 a.m. Eastern time, is generally between 450 and 550. So this was 785. Yeah, that's much higher.
Yeah, yeah, and again, we'll find out more of these numbers soon, and we'll have them all at worldsoccertalk.com. Now, the one that got impacted the most by these numbers, Kartik, was the Bundesliga. And I think it's one of those things, and I know I've always said it too, that the Bundesliga is a great league. I love watching it. I love the clubs and the way that this league is run, and the talent level. But at the end of the day, when the Premier League comes along, people gravitate to that and will not be watching the Bundesliga. And we saw with the Bundesliga, when it had no competition, that the numbers were roughly between 300,000 and 400,000 people watching that on English language television. Plus the Spanish language, it ended up being about 500,000 in total, which is great numbers for the Bundesliga. Now that the Premier League has returned, and now that La Liga has returned, the numbers from this past weekend, with an asterisk, because Bayern Munich has already won the title, and but RB Leipzig against Borussia Dortmund on FS2 on Saturday was 67,000 viewers. And then Bayern Munich against Freiburg on FS1 on Saturday at the same time was 65,000 viewers. And to me, personally, that tells me that that's pretty much the hardcore Bundesliga audience. Is you're talking, I mean, maybe double that. So maybe 150,000 to 200,000 people are interested in the Bundesliga in this country versus, say, the Premier League, which you're talking about anywhere from, at a low point, probably 500,000 to, a couple of million or a few million, depending on what game it is and who's playing at the same time. Are you disappointed by those numbers, Kartik?
Yeah, I'm also disappointed that Fox showed Bayern and Freiburg on FS1 and the bigger match with second place on the line between Dortmund and Leipzig on FS2. And the FS2 number, this is a rarity. Maybe the first time it's happened in the 5 years Fox has covered the Bundesliga, the FS2 number was actually higher than the FS1 number, which shows that they made the wrong selection of match.
Yeah, and even for this weekend, which is the last day of the regular season of the Bundesliga, the FS1 game that they've got scheduled, I think, is Wolfsburg against Bayern Munich. And we have the TV schedule at worldsoccertalk.com, but anyway, they always put Bayern Munich at FS1 guaranteed in that spot. I wonder if it's contractual, because it just does not make any sense. I mean, they've already won the title. Yes, they have a big fan base, and yes, we see that the numbers on FS2 are actually greater than FS1, which says a lot, because FS2 numbers are usually abysmal. I wonder if there is anything contractual there where they have to put Bayern Munich in that slot, or if it's just more of a somebody thinking like, oh, you mean Bayern Munich's going to get the most number of viewers no matter what? Well, that's not the case in this point. All right, Kartik, listener mailbag. I know you were away for a couple of weeks, so we've got a lot of comments from this past week from people. First up is Tim Murphy. Tim says, curious if your fine website has a regular listing of English Premier League games that are available in 4K. DirecTV has at least three channels devoted full-time to 4K, and they regularly carry at least one Premier League match per week in 4K. With the return of the Premier League last week, I noticed that the Man City against Arsenal game on June 17th and the Spurs-Man United match on June 19th were scheduled for broadcast in 4K. Well, Tim, I do not have a direct answer to that question. I do know that DirecTV and Comcast Xfinity both have some games, and it's not a lot, but they have some games in 4K through those TV providers. So I think on the Comcast website, there's a page that lists the games that are coming up. They're going to be in 4K, and the same with DirecTV. So if you're a DirecTV subscriber or a Comcast X1 subscriber with a 4K television, and you might have to have a 4K package on top of that too, definitely check out those programming guides. That's probably the best place to check, because I could have the listings on worldsoccertalk.com, but there's so few games, and there's so few TV providers that offer the games in 4K that at this point it doesn't make sense at this point. Next up is Disco George. The discussion on the podcast about MLS's approach to the MLS is Back tournament reminded me of something that was brought up about MLS on TV a few podcasts ago. Your argument was that most MLS teams have no identity, and you used Real Salt Lake and Sporting Kansas City as an example of something that wouldn't catch the interest of the country at large. The thing is, if the league office didn't equate identity with TIFOs and 50,000 attendances and actually tried to develop some of the stories around Major League Soccer, there are narratives out there that could attract audiences. Real Salt Lake and Sporting Kansas City have one of the few organic rivalries in the league, one that has been built up over years between both the players and the fans, and encompassed controversial endings in both regular season and playoff matches. But since it doesn't have a cute rivalry week name and there are no big name foreign stars involved, the league and its TV partners just pretend like it doesn't exist. So the old trope that the smaller clubs are all the same and never do anything interesting continues to prevail. Kartik, what's your take on this?
Yeah, I think that's true, that they do have a rivalry. It's been developed, one, because Colorado, which is the team geographically in between them, have had not many active fans and have at times not been very good. to be perfectly blunt about it, and even when they are good, they're just, the Rapids are just kind of there. But I would equate this more to like the rivalries in England and in Germany that happen because teams are in the same relative bracket and have a lot of controversial games or just some big matches with huge implications. Salt Lake and Kansas City, particularly in the era when Kreis and Lagerwey were still at RSL and Vermees is still managing Kansas City, but that early part of the 2010s, there were some really epic matches. The rivalry I compare it to, I guess, is Sunderland and Coventry in England, a rivalry many people don't know about. But they were always kind of in the same bracket for many years, whether they were in the top division or in the second division, and they were an incredible amount of coincidences where they played in critical matches or one of impacted the other's survival or promotion.
Yeah, I think if I remember correctly, it was JP Manning that got really upset with me on Twitter about the podcast we had a few episodes ago where I mentioned San Jose. Actually, I don't think I mentioned San Jose, but JP brought up San Jose as an example. And San Jose has a very rich history even before Major League Soccer and within Major League Soccer. But it's a team that from last year's TV schedule, other than the games, the Cali Clasico games, which are like, what, twice a year, I think there was zero number of games from San Jose that were on national television. So going back to Disco George's point, it is a valid argument, is that there are these teams with interesting histories that have interesting backstories that have both on and off the pitch that have great stories to tell I'm not hearing them. I mean, when I tune in to watch a national broadcast, and it's usually what, LA Galaxy against NYCFC live from Yankee Stadium, I'm like, oh my gosh, come on, not again. But I mean, to me, I could literally spend about 30 minutes. I mean, take any team from the top two divisions of English football. I could spend the next 30 minutes talking about, pick any one team, about that team, the history, the city that they come from, and the traditions, and the cups that they've won, or the types of players, the way that they play their football, which is different than others, intertwined with politics. We could do a whole show on any of those clubs. But seriously, I mean, and I know a lot about soccer, but I'd be hard pressed to spend 5 minutes talking about Real Salt Lake or Colorado Rapids or Sporting Kansas City and giving anything more than 5 minutes of information, because, I mean, I think MLS does a really poor job of communicating that. And it's mostly the television side. So if you go to the website, I'm sure there's a ton of information there, I would hope. But on television, it's just really, I mean, if those teams are on national television, it's a rarity. Sporting Kansas City is probably the exception there. But for the most part, those other teams are ignored. It's really as if they don't exist, which is a shame. Next up, JP says, Nick has been a nice change of pace filling in for Kartik. Nothing against Kartik, but imagine the discussion about the ESPN and Fox squabble and production costs would have turned into a Fox bashing session for being too cheap and not caring about soccer. Nick actually pointed out ESPN's projections may be too high, and given the probable ratings, it likely wouldn't be able to be recouped anyway. Fox is being prudent regarding MLS versus European leagues. Yeah, I'm sure most would choose La Liga most of the time, but most of the time they don't directly compete with Major League Soccer time slots. MLS's competition is other US sports, as Edwin has already commented. To beat a dead horse, EPL and other European leagues would see a ratings dip if they directly competed with US sports time slots, as seen when NFL is in season for afternoon matches. I'm not sure I agree with that, though, Kartik, because, I mean, and that's the thing, we will never know. We will never know what the ratings are like for Premier League games during prime time on US television. The closest we can come to it is ICC, and depending on which summer of ICC you look at and look at some of the games that were shown in prime time, some of the numbers were huge. Some of the numbers were big numbers. Some of the numbers were small. It's just, I don't know. It also depends which teams there are. So if it's a Man United against Chelsea in an ICC game, as opposed to, no offense, but Everton against I don't know, LA Galaxy, I mean, the numbers are going to vary drastically because of the size of those fan bases.
There was a game, Everton LA Galaxy, right?
Yeah.
We went to that match.
Yep.
You and I
in
were
Miami.
There, right.
Yep.
Yeah. I'd forgotten about that. You said it, and I thought, oh, that's a ridiculous example. But yeah, there was actually an ICC match between those two teams. Yeah, I think that that's absolutely right. But I also think that what we have found is that if events are on ESPN, there just seems to be a credibility about them. And I can't explain this among and it comes from a lot of soccer fans who are also fans of other American sports. There's a credibility that Fox doesn't have. I mean, I guess NFL fans tend to like Fox, but there are people who complain to me, honestly, about Fox coverage since they took over the U.S. Open rights in golf, the USGA rights. People complain about that. They complain about their coverage of college basketball. They complain about their coverage of Big Ten football versus when matches are on ABC or games are on ESPN or ABC in that conference. So I think the Fox thing is pretty universal. Quite frankly, I think they've made improvements in soccer. I think they've done a lot better the last few years than they were several years ago, but it's still not at the same standard as ESPN, in my opinion, and in the opinion of many others.
Well, that's the thing, too, about the whole discussion about the production costs and how much a Fox broadcast of a Major League Soccer game compares to a ESPN broadcast of an MLS game, too. And, I mean, Fox is, I wouldn't say cheap, I mean, like, prudence is probably a good word that JP mentioned, but it's a lot less than what ESPN is spending. So either ESPN is spending a lot more than they should be, or maybe that is the real legit number, and that's an accurate number of what it should be. And then Fox, for a same game, is spending $50,000 less. And maybe the scale, which we've seen actually from a lot of the Fox MLS broadcast, they scale back a lot. They don't have as much maybe talent or as much people kind of in the stadium. You can definitely notice a big difference. But going on to the next comment, which segues perfectly into that, from Turfit. Turfit says, I'm not a fan of Fox, but $125,000 per match is outrageous for production costs when a lot of these matches will be lucky to get 125,000 viewers, especially on FS1. Cost of productions should be lowered since it's all in the same location. Coming off a lockdown, how will they recoup money from advertisers? Articles that I have seen state most businesses are cutting back on advertising to recoup money they have lost during the lockdown. Next year or two may be bad for leagues that are renewing their TV contracts, and MLS is one of them. And also the next year or two will be hard on broadcasters that are tied up in overpriced contracts with leagues if they are not able to keep their sponsors.
Yep, that's... Turfit, you're spot on. This is a piece of analysis I've been sharing myself with several of my friends privately. Absolutely right.
Yeah. And that's the thing, though, too. I mean, the world has changed. I mean, going back to the Turner comment, too, Turner quitting on the Champions League, I'm sure a lot of it was from the financial aspect of it. They were looking at the budgets, going, okay, we're contracted, we're obligated to spend this money in the next 12 months, and looking at the advertising, looking at the dollars coming in, can we break even? And are we going to lose money on this next 12 months, or say 13 months of the Champions League and Europa League? And is it worth it? Should we just pull the plug now? And I'm sure that was part of the reasoning why they considered doing that and ultimately decided to go ahead and give it back to UEFA and let UEFA deal with it. It's not a good place for any broadcasters at this point. I mean, so many of them have had layoffs. So many of them have lost money. So many of them are in a tough spot. And a lot of these contracts are worth, hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars. And for whatever reason, again, going back to our very earlier point a couple of hours ago, UEFA and Turner agreeing, the lawyers agreeing to have an opt-out clause in there to allow Turner Sports to go ahead and just pull out without any contractual issue in there, to stop them, prevent them from doing that. That's really strange, and I'm sure UEFA is probably regretting that right now. All right, next up is addition by relegation. I'm a teacher, and thus off right now. I'll watch the 9 a.m. kickoff games, but few others will. Robert says, maybe I'm naive in my support for Major League Soccer, being a football snob who believes watching what they consider the best football is not going to help build football here. I have seen some terrible games watching the EPL and La Liga. So, Nick, watch what you want. But your opinion is meaningless as far as I'm concerned. On a different topic, you could sure see the difference between the Bundesliga and the Premier League games. Dortmund looked really good. Leicester versus Watford and Arsenal versus Brighton were fairly poor games. Leicester better get it together if they want to stay in the top four. At least Arsenal continues to look like a bottom 10 team with all those millionaires running around looking so overpaid. Next up is Shane Rowe. Shane says, I hate to be a contrarian, but I'm sure many other people hold the same sentiments. I don't think I can watch football until stadiums can use their capacity. The virtual attendance gimmick is an insult to football values. Fans have to be in attendance. It's a community game. The viewing experience is just horrid. The lack of physical fans just makes broadcasts incomplete products. And Kartik, with you not being on the podcast for the last 2 weeks, if you had to rank the crowd noise / virtual fan experience for the leagues that you've seen so far, who would be number 1, 2, 3, and 4?
Well, the Bundesliga would be one. The Premier League would be two. I would say that when you're talking about this, though, I'd go back to the point I made initially. Serie A seems more normal because we're not used, with the exception of the new Juventus Stadium, as you mentioned, and a couple other places. Livorno times has had really good atmospheres, etc. We're not used to having great atmospheres at Serie A matches. We're used to just having to watch the football. And sometimes watching the football isn't satisfactory when the competing league has great ambiance, great kind of color around the match, and great football as well. Now, with all those things having been eliminated and nobody has actual crowds, Serie A is holding up really well compared to the other leagues. So I think maybe they're the big winner in all this. So I would say in terms of the foul crowd noise, and pumped at the broadcast, I give the Bundesliga the nod on that. But I think overall this whole idea of closed-door stadiums, and again, it's early, and I take your point on those Coppa Italia semifinals. They weren't very good. The final was better. Napoli mm-hmm. played really well in the final. Yeah. The Serie A is the big winner of this week because it seems like it's more normal than and the football's been really good too, but more normal than the other leagues.
Yeah. It's a good point there, Kartik. My four, and I may have changed this since last week, but number one would be La Liga, and when it initially launched, I didn't like it. I was like, oh my gosh, the crowd noise is just so subdued, it's so mellow. But it made me think about it too, because most of the crowd noises in La Liga are mostly mellow. You hear the buzz of the noise of the crowd, and unless it's Real Madrid, or if it's
Valencia is the exception.
Valencia, or sometimes Atletico, or sometimes Athletic. I mean, but for the most part, if it's a Villarreal game or something like that, it's more of kind of a mellow noise, and you hear a little bit of noise, and that's what we get from the artificial crowd noise with La Liga. And it seems to be, and I can't guarantee it, but it seems to be the virtual fans, where they have they've painted the seats virtually in all of the La Liga games, that seems to have improved week by week. So as far as the way they've designed it and spread it out a little bit, and watching a game and not seeing the empty seats, I think subconsciously and consciously makes it more appealing to me. So I think they've got the right balance in between those two. The Bundesliga, I'd put number two. Excellent crowd noise. The empty seats is kind of glaring, but it's reality. And then I think number three would be probably Serie A with a total silence. But you mean it is what it is. That is reality, right? And then number four is the Premier League. And the Premier League is just that the crowd noise is just so disappointing for a league that has one of the best crowd noises other than the German league. It's just a lot of nothing. And they've topped off the bottom sections. I thought Man United, Old Trafford, the way that they topped their sections off and had some of the messages there. And I thought Liverpool, those were better, but not big fan of the tops overall. All right. What a crazy world we live in, Kartik. Last comment. This one's from Raymond Orozco, and this one's definitely up your alley. Some people complain about the lack of different champions in the top European leagues, and this is coming from Raymond Roscoe. But what this really is a direct result of financial fair play and how it failed to give us more competitive soccer in Europe.
Yeah, in fact, I would argue financial fair play gave us less competitive soccer in Europe. It locked in the top clubs, because basically financial fair play, just in layman's terms, puts a cap on what you can spend based on your revenues. So which clubs have more revenues? The more successful historical clubs, the clubs that have better sponsorship deals, the clubs that have bigger stadiums, the clubs that have better rights deals with other things, which sell more kits, etc. So, yeah, it's locked that in. And unfortunately, the one impact of the COVID break, we'll never know. But it looked like this might be the year Bayern or Juventus did not win their leagues. And in fact, I think what the COVID break did in Germany is it gave Hansi Flick a couple of weeks to really kind of implement a new system, a new style with Bayern. And you saw Thomas Müller and Leon Goretzka in particular. Those two players just elevate their games upon the restart. And Bayern pulled away from Borussia Dortmund and Leipzig and the chasing pack. And we're recording this on Thursday. With Lazio's loss to Atalanta on Wednesday, it looks like Serie A might be done too. And this really looked like the year Juventus could get caught. The closed door match with Inter right as COVID was striking was maybe a match that would have gone the other way if there had been a crowd or there hadn't been a COVID crisis. So we'll never know. But yeah, the lack of competition, in my opinion, is due more to financial fair play than anything else. I know Bayern was a dominant club in Germany historically, but you saw years where Wolfsburg were winning titles. You saw a year where Stuttgart won a title. You saw a couple of years where Borussia Dortmund won a title. You saw a couple of years where Schalke and Werder Bremen pushed them before financial fair play really kicked in. And that club was one of the great advocates of financial fair play, Bayern. They were the ones in the media whose most prominent directors were campaigning openly for this and chastising the Chelseas and Manchester Cities of the world. So, yeah, Raymond, I completely agree with your comment.
Yeah, the one thing, though, Kartik, is I wouldn't – I mean, Juve have not impressed me from what I've seen this far. So there's always the possibility that they might slip up. The challenge is that they play Lecce on Friday – and Lecce isn't the greatest of teams, so but maybe perhaps a draw in that game, and then things are still opened up again. But
he looked really abject. You watched Coppa Italia; they looked bad in that Milan game, but so did Milan. But against Napoli, how they got the penalties was amazing, because the reality is Napoli battered them for most of the second half, and I was surprised Gattuso was so aggressive with his tactics, but he could sniff Juventus's vulnerability. They have not been impressive. They haven't been impressive all year, quite honestly. Sarri has a system, an attractive system of football, which doesn't really kind of fit the Juventus personnel. So it's maybe Sarri was just better off at a place like Chelsea, where Abramovich wanted those tactics, or Napoli, where he had the freedom to sign the players he wanted. Because Juventus, that their squad just doesn't fit what he's trying to do.
Yeah, and speaking of Juve and in the Champions League, I have to think of one more thing about the Champions League coverage and about all the big news that we broke. Sports Business Daily broke yesterday, but we're talking about it in depth on this podcast. Is that you look at the Champions League on US television, and you look at the last year or so on Fox Sports, where they knew that they had lost the rights to Turner. And then you go into the current deal, and you know that within a season and a few months after starting the Turner broadcast, that they had lost their rights on this one too. And rather than mailing it in the final season, they just decided to chuck it in and give it back to UEFA. And now you have a season and a few games up in the air, which could be CBS if they pick it up. It would be a smart move by them, but it doesn't prevent any other broadcaster. Another broadcaster could come in and take it for a season and a few games. And then you look at the next TV rights deal then under CBS, and CBS has it for, I think it's three years. And you look at it and think, okay, UEFA, maybe this is the time to start thinking about having much longer deals in place, because in order to have that continuity and have that excellent coverage, and have, like with the Premier League and NBC Sports doing a six-year deal, which allows them to put in more resources, more planning, more fan fests, more trips to the UK to do even kind of on-site for a week or two, interviews and all that stuff, all the amount of investment that goes into it. I hope that UEFA looks at this and says, hey, you know what I mean? I think we need to do these six-year deals, because, yeah, those three-year deals are great as far as bringing in the money, you mean, and hoping that those rights go up every 3 years, bigger and better. But let's hold out for a bigger deal. But, yeah, I just hope at the end of the day, Kartik, is that the UEFA Champions League and the UEFA Europa League on the English language side, that the coverage doesn't get kind of a piss poor effort on this one. Because I mean, on the Spanish language side, I have full confidence TUDN and Univision and Unimas will cover the games, and their coverage will be excellent as it has been. But the English language side is a big question mark, and I just hope that they don't screw it up, whoever takes the rights on for this next year and some games. All right, listeners, we want you to have your say. I'm sure you have opinions and observations and questions and probably angered by some of the things we've said, or probably want to go a little bit deeper and dive into some other topics. Let us know. You can always reach us via email through web at worldsoccertalk.com, as well as facebook.com/worldsoccertalk, and on Twitter at worldsoccertalk. Plus, of course, you can always post your comments on worldsoccertalk.com. And Kartik, heading into another weekend of football from around the world, you got the NWSL that's back. You've got the Premier League title race question mark, Serie A title race question mark, Bundesliga on its final day of the regular season on Fox. This is going to be the last weekend. And the question mark about the whole relegation playoffs games and Fox Soccer Match Pass ceasing business on June 30th, which is like, what, next Wednesday? A lot of question marks about where those games will end up being shown, if they're shown at all. Man, there's so much going on, but what should they do?
Enjoy your football.
The softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.